This is Rabbi Sharon Brous, Rabbi at Ikar, where we're dedicated to reinvigorating Jewish community, ritual, and learning, all while laying the foundation for a just and loving society. You're listening to Ikar's podcast, where you can hear our sermons from Shabbat and holidays, our teachings, our guest speakers, basically anything we think worth hearing that we can capture and stream, you can listen to right here. The whole Megillah. I mean, literally, the whole Megillah. So thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, folks. This is my Shabbat sermon, which I delivered yesterday after spending several days in New York City and visiting the protest site and the encampment at Columbia University. At Columbia, we have seen an increasingly virulent strain of anti-Semitism, which I believe is absolutely toxic to any movement for justice and must be addressed. I'm also very concerned, as progressives often are, about sounding the alarm about anti-Semitism because it leads to a certain kind of moral panic. What we're witnessing right behind me today on Sunday, the very next day, is here at UCLA, where a group of pro-Israel protesters have come to face off with the pro-Palestine protesters. There is another way, folks. The language here is increasingly problematic, increasingly violent, and increasingly dangerous. There's a small group of people from Standing Together, from Omdim Biachad, who are here demanding, insisting that there is another way, and I pray that we hear them. There is no justice in a space where there is anti-Semitism. There's no justice where there is anti-Palestinian sentiment, where there's anti-Arabism. We can do better. We must do better. We must de-escalate. This is not the way to peace.
This week, I rewatched John Lewis's first television interview after the murder of George Floyd. When he was asked what he thought about the racial justice uprising that was emerging around the country, at some point, Representative Lewis said slowly and clearly, "It becomes necessary to use our bodies to help redeem the soul of the nation." It will surprise none of you to hear that I resonated deeply to that call then as I do now, because ours is a proud tradition of protest, which we remember especially this week, the week of Passover, as we celebrate the exodus from Egypt with urgency and intention, each one of us as though we personally were brought up from enslavement and degradation to liberation and to dignity. Our national liberation was made possible by a series of brave acts of resistance, of protest. The first two chapters of the book of Exodus, perplexingly absent from our Haggadah, form a proud playbook of protest, modeling what it takes to defy an unjust ruler and achieve national liberation. From Shifra and Pua, the midwives who courageously disobeyed Pharaoh by saving the lives of Hebrew babies, to Yocheved and Amram, who bore a child in defiance of Pharaoh's decree, and who, at least according to the Midrash, were encouraged to do so by their five-year-old daughter Miriam and her prophetic insistence that they go on living and loving despite the risk. There's also Bat Paro, Pharaoh's own daughter, Batya, who flouted the rules of her own home in order to save baby Moses from her father's decree. These people lived under a brutal authoritarian regime, and every act, every gesture was an act of defiant protest that could have cost them their lives. The moral message here is clear. No matter how great the risk, we do not accept the world as it is. We do not remain silent in the face of oppression and injustice. We use whatever tools we have to protest. And lest we perceive this to be just the stuff of narrative and not law, the rabbis codify the instinct to protest into an affirmative obligation. We have many times studied together in this community the rabbinic insistence in Masechet Shabbat that anyone who has the ability to protest against the wrongdoing of members of his household, but fails to protest, that person is held accountable for the sins of the members of his household. And anyone who has the ability to protest against the wrongdoing of the people of his town, but fails to protest, is held accountable for the wrongdoing of the people of his town. And anyone who has the ability to protest the wrongdoing of the whole world, but fails to do so, is actually held accountable for the wrongdoing of the whole world. And the rabbis meant it. Make no mistake, Rashi writes, we are literally punished for the bad behaviors of others that we fail to protest. And Ibn Ezra makes it even more clear. The legal status of the person who oppresses and the one who witnesses the oppression but remains silent is the same. Perhaps the Jewish dedication to protesting injustice is fueled by these halachic mandates. Or perhaps for others, it's fueled by some deep theological instinct. Or maybe it is just simply and profoundly a response to the lessons learned of our own repeated encounters with persecution and pain. Listen to the often quoted words of Rabbi Joachim Prince at the Lincoln Memorial in 1963. It is not merely sympathy and compassion for the Black people of America that motivates us. It is, above all and beyond all such sympathies and emotions, a sense of complete identification and solidarity born of our own painful historic experience. So whether it is an expression of solidarity or faith commitment, Jewish people have proudly been a part of every great protest movement in this country's history, from the fight for the abolition of slavery to the struggle for fair labor laws, from the movements for justice for Black Americans to anti-war protests, to the movement for women's rights and justice for LGBTQ people, to the reproductive and climate justice movements of our time. This is no accident of history, and it is no coincidence. These commitments are built into our collective conscience. It is perhaps this history, the centrality of these commitments to our own self-understanding, that makes this movement, this protest movement that has today gripped the nation, feel so fraught and for many of us so profoundly dissonant, so personal and so painful for many in our Jewish community. We witnessed the mushrooming of this movement in the immediate aftermath of October 7th, before our dead were even counted, let alone buried. This movement that accused Israel of genocide, a word thoughtfully chosen to trigger our multi-generational trauma. It was not long before that cursed accusation was directed not only toward the state of Israel, but toward Jews who were walking to Shabbat services here in America, or just walking around wearing a kippah in public. We've witnessed the threats and acts of violence, the targeting of Jewish students on campus, shouts of "Go back to Poland." We've heard the threats that "We will do October 7th again and again and again to you." And we've all seen videos of protesters screaming, "We are all Hamas." Protesters simultaneously denying Hamas's systematic use of rape and sexual assault against women, girls, and men on October 7th, and justifying those same acts of violence as legitimate resistance. On my kids' campus, some in the supposedly more peaceful on-campus protests held up a sign last week in the encampment that read, "The hostages are dead, get over it." For some reason, I have to admit that that hurt me more than many of the other protest cries, for its utter cruelty and lack of empathy. I'm saying this here today not to sensationalize and not to re-traumatize. I'm saying it because all too often when concerns are raised about the alarming increase in overt anti-Semitism that is emerging from these spaces and more, we have been met with a disinterested shrug. Well, we're told, there are Jewish students who have found a political home in the encampments, so how anti-Semitic can it actually be? Or the congresspeople who have taken up the mantle of fighting this anti-Semitism are self-interested hypocrites. As if that diminishes the pain of a Jewish kid when she's called a Nazi bitch as she's walking home from Shabbat services down Broadway last week. The entire movement is not anti-Semitic, but these are also not isolated incidents. And not every insurrectionist needed to wear a Camp Auschwitz t-shirt or a 6 million were not enough t-shirt in order for us to understand the distinct threat that the insurrection posed not only to our democracy, but to our Jewish safety. And today, a hell of a lot of people are comfortable associating with a movement that one campus rabbi I greatly respect, who is not an anti-Semitism alarmist, described to me this week as pre-pogrom. Our Jewish students have been put in an untenable position by this gaslighting. And it demeans our universities, which are intended to be places of learning and growth, critical thinking, questioning, and deeper understanding. And it threatens our democracy because, as I have said and will say again, the last bulwark against authoritarianism is a strong democracy coalition, which is now being shredded before our very eyes. And the gaslighting undermines our movements for justice. Because just to be clear, you cannot resist one illiberal regime by propping up another. That is madness. And you can't claim to fight racism while simultaneously promoting or even just quietly accepting racism. And yes, anti-Semitism is racism. And you cannot decry unjust use of force while simultaneously celebrating and even threatening more unjust use of force. You cannot plead for the humanity of one people while simultaneously dehumanizing another people. It is clear now that for many people, the protests are fueled not by a heartfelt desire for peace and by an end to war, and by a desire for an end to this terrible occupation, or even by a desire for reparations, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The resounding call of this movement is not liberation, it is annihilation. The end of the war is not the goal, the end of Israel is. One student at my daughter's university, I'm sure you've now read, one of the leaders of the encampment, posted several months ago a viral video claiming that Zionists do not deserve to live. The same way that we are very comfortable accepting that Nazis don't deserve to live, he said, racists don't deserve to live. Zionists, they should not live in this world. When pressed by university administrators to recant this week, the student stood by his words. Only later did he post a statement saying that he regretted that his words were taken out of context and that he had spoken in any case in the heat of the moment. But one does not call for the annihilation of another people, a call to mass violence against a people who in living memory had a third of our population gassed to death in the heat of the moment. That's not a slip up, friends. That is racist indoctrination, and it's decades in the making. And by the way, I am not a fan of police on our college campuses. And yet I do believe that there have to be consequences when a student threatens other students. And just before Shabbat, I heard that this student might not be allowed back on campus now. So where did all of this come from? Many protesters today are parroting a maximalist fantasy of the total eradication of Israel. A rhetoric that has been propagated by the Islamic Republic of Iran, a regime that has been hell-bent on Israel's destruction now for nearly 50 years. And wittingly, or maybe unwittingly, protesters are becoming proxies of the same regime that is responsible for the death of Mahsa Amini, the young woman arrested by the morality police in 2022 for not wearing her hijab properly. I believe it is a great stain on the conscience that so many of these same people now gleefully practicing chanting Mar Bar Israel, death to Israel, remain indifferent to calls to join the Women, Life, and Freedom movement to protest the brutal repression of women under the regime. Just this week, both Hamas and the Islamic Republic of Iran praised these students. I want to ask you to let that sink in for just a moment. Hamas and the Islamic Republic of Iran took the time to praise the students on our campuses. I know that in this climate, it's hard to hear anything anymore. We have been pushed far beyond our capacity. We are raw and we are ragged and we are hurt and we are scared, and it is deeply personal. And everyone seems to have an agenda, everybody. And we have to be very careful not to dismiss or discredit an entire movement because of its worst elements. There is clearly a lot for us to learn from these protests and this protest movement. But I also want to be clear that a movement that normalizes virulent anti-Semitism is not a movement that will ever lead to justice. A movement that not only justifies but glorifies violence against civilians is not a movement that will ever lead to peace. A movement that is dishonest, that promulgates the same kind of fake news and denialism that so many of us rightfully decried when it appeared on the right under the previous administration, will never lead to true justice. I went to Columbia this week to witness the encampment and to try to understand what's really roiling the campus. Things apparently got pretty rough later that night when reports were that the Proud Boys, God help us, were planning to face off with protesters from around the city. But at the time of my visit, which was midday, there were many blockades set up for blocks on Broadway, a desperate attempt of the university to limit the entry of outside agitators to campus. The encampment is vast, with tents covering the whole West Lawn between Butler and Lowe Libraries. Students are there day and night. And the encampment itself was both contained and peaceful when I was there. Coincidentally, at precisely the same time that a congressperson whose daughter was arrested and suspended last week for protesting was visiting as well. There were long tables with prepared food, and there was in the encampment a palpable sense of community, of belonging and purpose, it occurred to me. There are, I realized, many people who are drawn to this movement, not because they detest Jews or because they want Israelis to die, but because the movement feels both righteous and right. Hatred is strong, cheap fuel for protest, but belonging and shared purpose can also be a powerful force for organizing. In his new book, Rabbi Scheiheld writes of our Jewish attachment to protest. The refusal to hide or look away, he says, is a manifestation of deep love. Faced with a world on fire, we will not grow calloused or indifferent. We will continue to care even when it hurts. And so the Jew is called simultaneously grateful for a world saturated with so much beauty and indignant at a world suffused with so much suffering and injustice. In that spirit, I ask us today with a sincere and open heart, what would a movement look like that is fueled by belonging and shared purpose, that is a manifestation not of raw hatred, but of deep love? Because the Palestinian people are not Hamas, and their continued suffering is unconscionable. On the front page of today's New York Times, I read a story about a Palestinian family living in New Jersey who have lost 200 of their family members in Gaza. The Palestinian people have struggled for years under an unjust and seemingly ever more entrenched military occupation, and they yearn for and they deserve sovereignty. And because there are 133 hostages who remain in Gaza, who must be returned to their loved ones. Because Hirsch is alive. Hirsch is alive and he needs to be home with his mother and his father and his sisters, and he and all of them need urgent medical care. And the people there in Israel and Palestine, millions of people deserve to have a future. They deserve to live in peace, to thrive and to grow and to farm and to learn. They deserve to dream and to rebuild and to heal. It strikes me now that our diaspora communities must be very careful about the messages that we are advancing. Our protest movements are a reflection of the reality that we are fighting to manifest in this world. This may be the call of our time. Instead of a movement that fantasizes about annihilation, could we imagine a movement fueled by empathy and moral imagination, one that recognizes that both people have suffered terribly and are deeply traumatized, and that neither is leaving, that a just future is possible? Such a movement would stand at the intersection of shared purpose and belonging. It would never downplay or deny the pain or trauma of the other. It definitely would not win the approval of the Proud Boys or Hamas or the Islamic Republic of Iran. But it would meet sorrow with sorrow. It would recognize that Jews and Palestinians deserve to live peacefully with full rights and dignities on a land that is sacred to both, that is home to both. Imagine how powerful a protest movement would be that did not make people choose between the humanity of one camp or another, that did not deny or diminish or fantasize about harm to the other, but instead embrace the humanity of every single person created in God's own image. I know that such a world is possible. Mo Husseini, a Palestinian American, wrote one of the most compelling articles I have read about this conflict in the past decade, and he posted it just before Shabbat. We would all do well to listen to him. He writes, I care deeply about Palestinian rights to freedom, security, and self-determination. And I am also profoundly aware that true long-term freedom, security, and self-determination for Palestinians cannot exist without creating a reciprocal reality for Israelis. You are not gaining freedom if you gain it at the expense of the other. There is no freedom, he says, that is built on the back of racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, anti-Arabism, or hatred of any form. We must remember, he writes, that people on both sides of this debate have faced historical traumas and present fears that shape their realities in ways that are painful, potent, and deeply personal. So the starting place is always empathy and an attempt to understand. In this way, Mo Husseini sounds to me a lot like Representative John Lewis. At some point, Lewis said, it becomes necessary to use our bodies to help redeem the soul of the nation. Protest, though, good protest, is not only about being willing to put our bodies on the line for what we believe in. It's about laying down the burden of hate and division, in John Lewis's words, so that all might truly thrive. We all live in the same house, he said again and again. Our goal is freedom and justice for all humankind. So yes, John Lewis, once again, you are right. Shabbat shalom.
Hi, it's Rabbi Brous again. Thank you so much for listening. Want more content like this? I hope you'll subscribe. And please consider making a contribution to IKAR so we can continue to work toward the fulfillment of our mission to reanimate Jewish life, to embody moral courage, to nurture the spirit, and to work to decipher what it means to be a human being in the world today. Visit our website at IKAR.org. That's IKAR.org. And I hope to see you, maybe even in person, sometime soon.